All right, hi everyone, and I'd like to officially welcome everyone to the first Association for Psychosocial Studies reading group of 2022. Just like to thank everyone for coming, and just as a matter of interest, this seems to be by far one of the more popular and definitely the most international of all our reading groups. I think we're spanning, by my quick count, at least four different time zones, which is really exciting. I'm really happy that you all can make it. So today I'm incredibly happy to have Andrew Shepherd, you know, leading our reading group. Andrew is a consultant forensic psychiatrist who works in a secure hospital and prison settings. He's also an honorary clinical lecturer at the University of Manchester. Andrew has ongoing research and teaching interests in psychoanalysis, the lived experience of mental disorders, and the enactment of mental health at institutional boundaries. And today, Andrew is going to be presenting his paper, which was published in the Journal for Psychosocial Studies, The Psychosocial Meaning Making in Carceral Spaces, a Case Study of Prison and Mental Health Care Practice. And without further ado, I'll turn it over to you, Andrew.
Thank you. This is quite exciting. So thank you for people giving up their time to come and speak about this. Thank you for the kind of introduction. I'm a consultant forensic psychiatrist. In the UK, forensic psychiatry deals with or works with people who, in the context of mental disorder or stress, may act with violence towards others. And we work primarily, I would say, in secure hospitals around the country. So in England and Wales, we have what are termed low, medium, and high secure hospitals. The high secure hospitals, we only have two, are Broadmoor and, I don't remember, Rampton for the women, and Ashfields, so three, sorry, for men. Broadmoor, obviously quite famous historically. Crowthorne, just outside London, has quite an interesting history. Forensic psychiatrists often, depending on the clinician, may also take on a role thinking about the interface between mental health and the law. And so I can't hear Andrew properly. I might just quickly grab a headset in that case if I'm too... Am I too quiet?
The audio isn't great. If you have a headset, that would be good. So hopefully we'll get that sorted. If everyone can just bear with us for a second.
Could you put the closed caption? Will be better for us.
Yes, I thought it was enabled. I'll just see if I can get that going now.
Is that better?
Yeah, it's clearer. Good.
Forgive me, sorry. I thought I was getting away with it. So I was just saying that forensic psychiatrists may also, in England and Wales, be involved in providing witness work for the court. So informing or helping the court to reach decisions and disposals when people are accused of crime. So, for example, the majority of the people in the hospital I'm working at the moment are detained under the Mental Health Act, but have been found guilty of a crime. Okay, so that's a bit about context. In England and Wales, mental health practice in prisons has a long history, but is a relatively recent emergence to be distinct from the practice of prison officers. It's about 20 years since the NHS was charged with providing healthcare in prisons. And we have now what are referred to as the integrated mental health teams, which tend to be nurse-led services with consultation from psychology and psychiatry services. So I work in a women's prison in the northwest of England. I've worked in men's prisons in the past, and that's where the interest for me in this paper came from, thinking about the nature and ethics of mental health practice within prison settings. So why is that important? Well, I suppose the starting point, and certainly the starting point when I'm writing funding applications, is to point out how common mental distress and suffering within prisons is, that there is a huge burden of mental ill health within prisons. Now, you can challenge the conceptualization of that. So, for example, mental disorders such as personality disorder, some epidemiological studies estimate that in excess of 80% of the prison population would suffer from a personality disorder diagnosis. But then if you're saying 80% of a population is disordered in some way, perhaps you need to think about your definition of disorder in that context. So if you're saying a person is dissocial in the wider community, that means one thing. It's very different to saying that a person is dissocial within a prison environment, for example. So we work in prisons to attempt to ameliorate distress, to help people to engage with their personal recovery with respect to their mental health experience, to help people to engage with their prison sentence, to help people move on with their lives. But that raises some interesting ethical challenges. How does one avoid becoming part of the prison institution? Ultimately, prisons are carceral institutions designed to punish. Do mental health practitioners moving into those settings, do we take on that more sadistic urge to punish the people that we're working with? And how do we avoid that difficulty? How do we, so for example, one of the role in England, one of the most severe things that we do to a person is to lock them in a room by themselves. In prison, that's called segregation. And a person who is placed in segregation receives a mandatory daily review by a general practitioner and say a healthcare nurse. And they will also quite often be referred for psychiatric assessment. Now, the rationale for that being that if a person is in segregation, they are under extreme stress and liable to need support. But the argument could become, are those healthcare practitioners enabling that suffering of that person by enabling them to remain in segregation? Was in a professionals meeting this afternoon where we discussed a woman who's currently in segregation and agreed to commence some medication because she is clearly significantly distressed and likely needs to move to hospital. However, because she is in prison, we can't instantly move her to hospital for legal reasons. So, but by prescribing medication, our aim is to reduce her suffering, but we are also going to be having an impact on the experience of people around her and arguably are using sedating medication to contain a distressed woman within a single cell locked up for more than 23 hours a day by herself. Is that ethically acceptable? There's a point of debate there. So the purpose of this paper, I thought, was to think through the experience of people within prisons, the experience of prisoners serving sentences. And the reason I think that's important is, well, hopefully it's apparent from the paper, but hopefully it'll become apparent as well, that when people are within prison, they become invisible to the wider population. And I've already alluded to the significant levels of mental distress, mental disorder in prison settings. So there is a significant amount of suffering that is rendered invisible to scrutiny within the prison system. And I think that I want to ask the question, is there an ethical duty to guide the gaze of society back onto that suffering and to recognize that it is there? Is that perhaps part of the duty of clinicians, practitioners going into prisons to help us look at that and think through that suffering? So I've written a little note here about prisons being alienating environments that take up in a marginalized population, that people going into prison are often already at the margins of their society, and by forcefully dislocating them from their host communities, we are further marginalizing them or alienating them from society. Now, you might argue in some cases, if a person has been violent within society, perhaps that is necessary for public protection, and perhaps it's necessary as a punishment for the individual. But then when we think about the sheer number of people in England and Wales who are serving prison sentences of less than 1 year, if they are marginalized and disadvantaged and then dislocated for a period of less than 1 year, they become further marginalized and disadvantaged, and then we ask them to be reintroduced to society, it becomes a vicious cycle, and phrases like revolving door become all too common, and hence the call for penal reform, for abolishment of sentences of less than 1 year for many people, it becomes stronger, I would argue. So in this paper, I tried to outline the nature of the prison environment through three sort of, I suppose, levels of focus: a macro, a meso, and a micro social focus. And so starting at the macro level, looking at the role of prison in wider society, this is where I think prisons, ironically, not every prison has a curtain wall, a perimeter wall, but that is certainly, I think, how most people imagine a prison as having an imposing perimeter wall. I worked for a while in HMP Liverpool, and it has a very imposing curtain wall in the centre of a residential area opposite quite a desirable park. I certainly was aware of the wall, that I had to park at one end of it, which was the same end as the healthcare, but then had to walk about half a mile in the cold winter of Liverpool, the length of this wall, through the wall, and then back the length of the wall inside. And you became painfully aware of the experience. But non-facetiously, the wall serves to demarcate the prison. And I think that the wall renders the prison highly visible to society around it. It becomes an imposing structure. In England and Wales, there are often these grand Victorian buildings that are likely no longer fit for purpose, but we still use and cram increasing numbers of people into. So the wall is very visible, draws attention, and obviously this Foucauldian notion of the visibility of the punishment and the imposition of discipline and order on the society that views the structure. But the wall also renders the prison opaque to scrutiny. You can't see through it. You can't look at what is going on inside. And I think that that has a very clear psychological impact at a population level, that it is very easy to define us and them, in inverted commas, that the person within the prison is intrinsically othered from the population from which they've been abstracted, and that opens up some challenging dynamics, I think it's fair to say. So at the meso level, thinking about the prison itself, the wall again serves here, doesn't it, that the purpose of the wall is to restrict the flow of material and information through it. Now, that restriction is partial. Material people do flow through the wall, sometimes desirably. Professionals move in, officers, healthcare practitioners, governors move in and out of the prison prisoners are released and brought in. Obviously, sometimes prisoners get out undesirably, rarely, but it happens. But other things flow in and out as well. Information becomes distorted. Artifacts that move through the wall become distorted. So for example, I sometimes think there's when one is moving into a prison, you surrender a lot of the trappings that a lot of us take for granted or as artifacts of modern life. So no mobile phones, no computers, no, the collection of items that is listed as a criminal charge to bring into the prison is extensive. I mean, my personal favorite is always fireworks. Why would you take fireworks into a jail? But obvious reasons why one shouldn't. As we surrender these items moving into the prison and in exchange are given officer or a practitioner in the prison environment, a set of keys in exchange. I think we take on a ritualistic element there. That it's when moving into, I always remember moving into a high secure hospital, how you, in the middle of winter, you would walk in fully wrapped up in your coat with various items about you and you would surrender them all to be scanned. You would pass in, you know, shirt sleeves and trousers through a metal detector that checked that you'd not brought anything untoward with you. And then you were allowed to re-gown, as it were, on the other side. And prisons have a similar process. Information is distorted as it flows through as well. I was struck by this recently working with a woman who is in prison for a violent offence. And there was supposed to be a press embargo on her, the nature of her offence, and that embargo was broken by the media prior to her sentencing, and there would be some repercussion for that. But the impact was that people within the prison found out why this woman was within prison and found out that she had been lying to people who asked her why she was in prison, and the result was a series of death threats made against her. Quite a visible impact of distortion and partial passage of information through the wall. And I think that as items move through the wall, they take on different values within the culture within the prison. And this first vignette that I present in the paper, the case of A, is meant to illustrate that. I'll touch on that briefly. Within the prison itself, obviously the most striking feature at a microsocial level is going to be the individual cell. These have largely remained, I'm always slightly sad when I go to a new city or a new place on holiday, I have to see if there's an old prison that I can tour. And I'm always struck by the similarity in the cells to the historical buildings. They're tiny spaces. People are crammed in, often with people they would choose not to spend time with if they were given the choice. They are humiliating in that a toilet and wash basin are available, but not screened off from. They're partially screened from observation from the window, but you can still see that the person is there, and your cellmate can certainly see that you're there while you go about your business. Cultures emerge within the prison. One of the, I've said that I worked with an HMP Liverpool, one of the football fans here will know there are two fairly major clubs within the Liverpool area, Liverpool and Everton. And let's just say that the fans of both don't necessarily mix. And the prison has to be aware of this culture within itself. And obviously, I've alluded to that offenders do not, prisoners rather, do not necessarily react positively to other offenders, and there are certain crimes that are seen as sitting within a hierarchy that will be discriminated against within the prison. And so these cultures emerge and need to be policed or managed to maintain the safety and function of the organization. So I present two vignettes in the paper. These are people that I met through clinical practice, and well, they're amalgams of people that I met through clinical practice and research. And A is a woman who is in for a violent offense, has a history of substance misuse, but identifies very strongly with that with her brother. And there's a very strong sense of familial identification there. It's the death of her brother that drives her to understand that, well, drives perhaps our understanding of her violence and the emergence of her violence towards people caring for her. And in the prison, she struggles extensively with instability, impulsive violence, aggression towards officers, aggression towards peers. But finds some stability through a new behavior of harming herself by cutting using a razor blade that is originally handed to her by another woman in the prison the first time she obtains a razor blade. And I suppose the idea here is the way that the razor blade comes to represent something for this woman in terms of relief of her distress. She bloodlets and so achieves a sense of anesthesia, I suppose, through keeping her hemoglobin at a sufficiently low level that she can introduce a sense of numbness in relation to her suffering. It also introduces an identity. People talk about being one of the self-harmers, in inverted commas, and it's a culture that emerges within the prison that provides people with a sense of relief, a sense of stabilization. And the way that this woman uses the razor blade to achieve her goals, uses the razor blade as a point of stabilization, and the distortion of that from what we would normally imagine the use of the item for people better shaved than myself to maintain their appearance. Yes, she also uses milk cartons, which she finds around the prison as a means to measure her blood loss, and leaves these around the jail as little artifacts for people to discover. B is a man who is in prison. When I first meet him for, he's accused of murder, he's convicted of the same. So in England and Wales, murder carries a mandatory life sentence. And what I hope to illustrate with B is the way that he narrates his experience and the way that he chooses to understand his experience and his violence. It is a friend that he's killed and the distress that is associated with that. But as he comes into prison and into contact with the criminal justice system, he is forced through a process whereby an external agency takes control of his narrative and takes it away from him and tells him how things transpired. This is the nature of the court process. The facts are tested and a narrative is developed. And in so doing, the person's narrative identity is made by the court. And I think this is an enormously powerful psychological process for someone to go through. When we think about narrative identity, the way that we make sense of ourselves in the world, the way that we think of therapy as a process of making sense of experience, to have the sort of inverse of that almost, the way that the identity of an offender, or in this case a murderer, is enforced on the person and the way that they have to deal with that. And I suppose here I offer something of a, I'm not seeking to be an apologist for murder here. The crime is wrong. The act of killing is clearly wrong and inexcusable, but that does not mean it's not something we ought to try and understand and work with the person to work through. I personally think I have a duty to attempt to understand the person's experience. B also demonstrates the divide between murder and the old term of self-murder, that when his identity is being challenged and undermined, the way that he experiences his suicidality emerges, and it becomes quite a prominent feature through self-hanging in the jail as he attempts to stabilize his experience. So I'm left thinking about this idea of narrating one's experience and how does one negotiate the idea of being an offender, a violent offender, a person who has killed? How does one make sense of that? Because we want people to make sense of that, because if prison is to work, in inverted commas, we want the person to go in, to undergo a transformation and to come out as a person who will no longer engage in that behavior. That is one aspect of the rehabilitation arm of prison, beyond the retribution. It's so narrating one's identity becomes significant, but narration is in a sense becomes a performance, in that you have to test your identity with other people to see how they will respond to you. That might begin a small scale, but and I think B's case illustrates how the court plays a role in this, that one's narrated identity is tested and maybe overcome by the power of the court, and one may be forced to deal with one's experience in a different way. Working with a young man who is convicted of a crime, suffers from psychotic experience during times of crisis, believes that people are able to read his innermost thoughts, to know and to see his guilt, and that people make assumptions about him, he believes, on the basis of their being able to psychically infer what he is thinking. And he struggles with having been found guilty of a crime that he still maintains that he did not commit. And part of his recovery in terms of his mental health must embrace that need to come to terms with what has been found of him, how he makes sense of that and how he will make sense of that and stabilize in the face of his psychotic experience remains to be seen. But so I'm listening about how do people make sense of these narratives? How do people perform these narratives to a wider society? And that, I think, brings up the question of, is society ready to hear these narratives, ready to hear this change? How do we, or do we, have a duty to support society to think about the experience of people who go through these processes? Or is a dismissal of their experience appropriate? I think there's an argument to be made there that some would say it's not appropriate to try and think through this. It is person has, well, there's a famous phrase in British prisons of, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. That ultimately we should be put off committing crime by these institutions, and they should just be places of suffering to encourage us not to break the law. That to me, I think we have ample evidence that doesn't work. The dissuasion through punishment is a poor strategy. So I personally think there is a duty on society to think about ways that it can look at the violence of people within it and try to understand that. But that can be challenging, deeply challenging. I'm not for a second meaning to understate the problem there, that how do we support communities to look at people who have broken the law and look at them through a restorative lens, to look at them through the process of restorative justice, for example. And I think there's something here about trauma in society, and I think this is my closing point, that I think that after 2 years of a pandemic, approaching 2 years, isn't it, March 2020 to, you know, coming up for 2 years now, I think we're a highly traumatized group of societies, institutions. And I was listening to an interview with a psychoanalyst who was talking about how working with trauma leads to projection into the therapist, and the therapist may respond, a polarity of responses, obviously, but two extremes might be to absolutely shut down and deny the suffering of the individual on one hand, and the other pole might be to over-identify with the suffering of the person. And I was thinking about this in the light of this argument of thinking about these invisible people within prisons. How is society supposed to respond? I'd argue that in many ways, by putting them within prison, rendering the prison invisible, are we denying the suffering of the people within it? But then I don't want to fall prey to over-identify with the trauma either. So how do we strike that balance between rejection and over-identification while holding compassionately in mind the suffering of the perpetrator, yes, but also the suffering of the victim who has been injured here. That is a, I think, roughly 30-minute whistle-stop tour of my current thoughts in relation to this, which is, I think, is what I was asked to provide. I'm not sure how I've done for timekeeping, but hopefully not too far off.
You're exactly 2 minutes under, so you can maybe get one last point in if you like.
I think I've probably exhausted people with my voice, and I will take a step back.
All right, great. Thank you, Andrew. I really appreciate that presentation. It was really, really quite interesting. So what we are going to do now, if you saw the schedule, is we're going to move in for a small group discussion. I'll go ahead and set it for maybe a wee bit longer than we had initially, because we typically do 40 minutes. So that means you're all going to be moved into a small group. You're going to get a prompt shortly. Just say join group when you get it. Andrew, you don't need to hit the prompt. But before I do, and before I stop the recording, if everyone would like to perhaps quickly turn your microphone on and join me in giving Andrew a quick round of applause. All right, thanks everyone.